The true model of Earth history is three cosmi separated by flood and fire, with decay taking place on the Earth, the second law of thermodynamics. But the law of conservation is keeping it from decaying until God has had it serve its purpose. And that Romans chapter 8, verse 21 and 22 says, the whole nature is groaning in travail from the result of Adam's sin, dying, decaying. Listen to me. The grass in your yard dies because Adam sinned. Nothing dies until sin enters the world. The trees are aging and dying because of sin. The whole universe is cringing, saying, great Zot, he sinned. I can't believe he sinned against the Creator God. A Greek philosopher says, you give me an order, I'll think it over. And when and if I understand it and agree with you, I'll obey it. How'd you like to be a general and have that kind of soldier with you? He's a philosopher. The Hebrew mind, like Abraham was, give me an order and I'll obey it. And as a result of my obedience, down the line, I'll understand it. You be obedient and believe God, and down the line, you'll understand this. I want you to understand also that Adam and Eve, just like they were created absolutely mature, grown individuals, that is, they were created with an apparent age, fully functional and ready to function. How do I know that? The first thing God said to them was, be fruitful and multiply. You don't tell that to three-year-olds. They were old enough to get on with the program of generating people. Just like that, the earth and the whole universe was created mature, ready for man to use, fully functional. And Adam and Eve were not brutes. They were not cavemen. They didn't go, You read Genesis chapter 2, and they were talking intelligently with God and with each other in chapter 3, and with their children. And they didn't have to develop fire over millions of years. By Genesis 4, Abel built a fire. So there was no false evolution that you read about in your textbooks of speech and the wheel and things like that. By Genesis 5, they had enormous civilizations built. And that light was, some people say, well, Floyd, it can't be true. It takes light billions of years to come from the stars. Millions of years to come from the stars. No, it doesn't. Just like Adam and Eve were created fully functional, the universe was created fully functional, the light was created hitting here. I might add this. Everybody doesn't agree. Some scientists that don't believe in God have done their own curved space theories, and they don't agree at all with the space, with the curves and the space distances that Hubble's law that all modern astronomy is based on get. Oh, these guys are getting that light can get here from the farthest stars in just 15 years. Now, I don't know who's right, and I really don't care. Light was created coming here. It was a created, mature universe with an apparent age. Not to deceive anybody, but it was made to be used immediately. Someone came to me last week and said, well, Floyd, I hear you're touching on Genesis. Who did Cain marry? His sister. Genesis chapter 5, verse 3 and 4 says Adam and Eve had a lot of children. God had not yet forbidden close interfamily marriages. The gene pool, the genetic load, was not great yet because they were so near the perfect creation that the genetic deterioration hadn't amounted to much. God let them intermarry. I want you to understand that in Genesis chapter 4, verse 16 through 17, it does not say that Cain went to the land of Nod, found a girl and married her, and they began to have kids. It doesn't say that. All it says is Cain went to Nod, and he and his wife had children. In other words, he was already married and took her with her, or maybe later on she followed him into exile. But the point is, there were no such people as Nodites. He didn't go over there and find a Nodite gal and marry her. The Bible teaches everyone came out of Adam and Eve in the New Testament and in the Old Testament. What we actually have in the geological column are many local geological columns. There has never existed a, quote, geological column with all the beds of the earth piled one on top of the other. The fossils don't represent, as we learned last time, the fossils don't represent great ages. What they represent, you see, they can't. They were all laid down at about the same time, Noah's flood. But the only exception is that the Bible reveals there were some rivers flowing through, for example, the Garden of Eden, four. Therefore, there could have been some sedimentation at that time. But not much, because if you'll recall, the Bible says in Genesis 2:5, it had not rained until the flood. Hebrews chapter 11 says that Noah teaches that Noah had never seen a flood, never seen rain. The people had never seen a rainbow. So you wouldn't have very much sedimentation without rain. And the fossils, the animals that had served their God-intended function at that time, the time of the flood, became extinct. And that all, therefore, all the geologic columns are just local. They're little local ones. What we're seeing when we go out in nature is seeing what was deposited at each given locale at the time of the flood of Noah. And it has been reasonably uniformly altered for the past 5,000 years by the processes of sedimentation and erosion and weathering, glaciation, wind, frost, and things like that that we see going on in the world today. 2 Peter chapter 3 teaches that the universe did not begin with a big bang, but that it will end with a big bang. Modern science has reversed the truth of God. The universe did not begin with the big bang. It's going to end with the big bang. And let me talk to you briefly, just make a few statements about the, you know, black holes. See, the television's being bombarded, the movies are bombarded with movies about the black hole, and there's, hey, the financial outlay is endless for these kind of things. And they talk about black holes all the time on television and in the movies and everything, and the scientific community is talking about it as though they just got through talking to a black hole 15 minutes before. Now, it's my duty as your brother to just let you in on the facts. No one's ever seen a black hole. We've never even spotted the results of a black hole in space. No one knows. See, science is what you know. It's what you can see and observe. No one's ever observed a black hole. But if we believe in the Big Bang, if we believe in a Big Bang, and if the Big Bang happened, then mathematically and philosophically, there probably ought to be some black holes out there. Oh. Well, that's different than actually telling me one day. But see, they don't teach it like that. They don't present it like that. And that angers me because it isn't good science. They tell us, see, they want you to sit down and say, perhaps life came from another planet. Well, let's be okay. You know, someone comes up to you. What are you going to do today? Someone comes up to you and says, let's consider the possibility that life came to this planet from another planet. Fine. Excellent. What planet? Name one. You see, in other words, no one's ever seen any planets in the whole known universe except the nine around our star, the sun. And we know there's no life on those. In other words, why should I waste my time intellectually pondering if maybe life came from some other planet out there? See, that's a waste of time until you at least find one. Now, we literally see billions of stars with the giant telescopes. I took astronomy when I was at the university. And I looked through some pretty big telescopes in my day. And we see literally billions of stars, but we've never seen a planet around any of them. Now, I can't prove, you see, that there are none out there, but it is odd we've never seen one. Now, let me say this. If there are any planets beyond what our telescopes see, traveling at the speed of light, it would take over 1,000 lifetimes to reach here. I mean that number, over 1,000 lifetimes at the speed of light. So if you want me to be intellectual and art, consider the possibility. Let's at least wait till they find another planet. Now, they're not going to find life superior to us on another planet. How do I know that? God said He made us in His image. Tell me what can possibly be higher than the image of God? How foolish. They're going to find any humans out there. How do I know that? Well, the scripture says so. Psalms 115 verse 16 says God made the earth for man. So if you're going to find any men in the universe, you're going to find them on planet earth. Let me tell you something else. If there were people out there, they'd be just like us sinners, and Jesus would have to go there and die for their sins. But the Bible in the book of Hebrews says Jesus dies only once. So they're not going to find anybody out there. You say, well, what is a black hole? Let me tell you what they're supposed to be. A black hole is supposed to be the result of a gravitational collapse of a star or something where it just begins to as it burns out, all the molecules, all the atoms and protons, neutrons, electrons just begin to collapse tighter and tighter and tighter until, and as it does, it gets more dense. And the gravitational pull gets tremendous as it gets super dense. And it begins to pull in all the material in space around it. And as it does this, it gets so dense, they tell us, that it finally gets so dense it'll even pull in light waves, or light particles, depending on what you believe about light. Photons, or wavicles, or particles, or whatever. Back when I studied, Lemaître was the guy that started the Big Bang. Not really. as a matter of fact, Plato believed in a Big Bang. He had his own version of a Big Bang. Aristotle believed in the steady state theory. And the Stoic philosophers all believe in a cyclic cosmos. So see, these aren't new. They're just up versions of the old Greek lost pagan philosophers. Lemaître, and then it was upgraded by George Gamow. These guys believed that all the matter in the universe came together in one place, and that as a result of all the particles getting so close together, attracted by gravity, that their heat of compaction finally got, they just kept packing in tighter and tighter by gravity, and as they did, so much heat was generated that it caused a thermonuclear explosion. I have a hard time with that, frankly, just scientifically, believing that heat of compaction will reach thermonuclear proportions. But even if it did, in those days, they said, now, you know, well, how big was all that mass? Well, they said, I don't know. Maybe, some of them said, well, maybe about the size of the solar system. But today, the boys in the Big Bang, now, you won't believe this, but this is the current, you know, this is where it is today, that all the matter in the universe came together, and it kept, I like North Mississippi talk, it kept squozing together, tighter and tighter, and it squozed in, so that the whole sum of all the matter in the universe was the size of a pinhead. And they call that singularity, the single point of all that. Now, I don't know about you, but that takes a little more faith than I've got. You know, to me, they have finally overstepped themselves into proving their stupidity. Nobody with no one. Now, you've got to have a lot of college education to believe that kind of bull. Now, if there was ever a black hole, if ever there was a black hole, that was it. All the matter in the whole universe at one point, the size of a pinhead. You see what I'm getting at? That would be so much force that an explosion wouldn't blow it apart. See, they've overstated their position now. They've made an impossibility out of the whole thing. Compromising Christians cannot abide a Christian that will not compromise. I do not compromise the Bible. I will not apologize for Genesis or 2 Peter chapter 3. The very existence of an uncompromising Christian is an indictment against compromising Christians who intellectually will not come to God as a child and believe the Bible. The united voice of paganism says that everything I've been telling you for the last 2 weeks is wrong. There is not one single lost scientist that will agree with what I've taught you. Not one single lost philosopher ever has said that this is right, that out of nothing there was a special creation by God and a special destruction by a flood, and that there's coming a special destruction by a fire in the near future, and that there'll be three cosmi. Not one lost man has ever agreed with that, scientist or philosopher. They all agree with some form of evolution uniformitarianism. Now, anytime the united voice of paganism says you're wrong, you're probably right. Not one of them agrees with me and with what I'm teaching you about the Bible. Well, the Bible clearly says these people's thinking is controlled by Satan. Anytime you believe anything and the whole lost world agrees with you, you better start getting nervous that you're wrong. The greatest act of creation, apart from God creating the heavens and the earth out of nothing, was Charles Lyell in the 1800s when he created millions of years on the geological column out of nothing and sold it to the scientific community. Incidentally, Charles Lyell was a lawyer, knew nothing about science. Before I continue, I'd like to read you a quote from Madeline Murray O'Hare. Now, listen very carefully to this. I am amazed that this avowed atheist seems to understand the issue better than most of my Christian brothers and sisters. I am now quoting from the American Atheist, which is the journal of Madeline Murray O'Hare, her atheistic organization. Here's what she says. Christianity is, must be, totally committed to the special creation as described in Genesis. It becomes clear now that the whole justification of Jesus' life and death is predicated on the existence of Adam and the forbidden fruit that he and Eve ate. Without original sin, who needs to be redeemed? Without Adam's fall into a life of constant sin terminated by death, what purpose is there to Christianity? None, she says. Beloved Madeline Murray O'Hare has obviously read the Bible enough to see what the issue genuinely is. She's right. She can see it, and it's most distressing that we have so many brothers and sisters that are trapped in this and can't see what the real issues in it are. Remember, Peter said to stir up your pure minds? You're going to need to stir up your minds. I want to demonstrate for you in these next minutes a very simple but very important principle to show you why evolution is not so. It violates the greatest known laws in physical science. Anytime a hypothesis violates a law, the hypothesis is wrong. Now, of all the laws known in science, if I had to stake my life on any of them, I would pick the first and second law of thermodynamics. They're always correct. They've been tested at every level, either on the galaxy size, down to your size, down to subatomic particle size, and they've held to be true. The first law of thermodynamics, now, don't get scared. I know when I said thermodynamics, that scares you to death, especially those of you without a technical background. But I'm not going to try and impress you with how much education I have. I've made this very, very simple so that without any science, you can understand the main points. Back in the old days, when you were in junior high, we called it the first law, the law of conservation of mass and energy. But you see, when you went to the university, we called it the first law of thermodynamics to scare you and impress you, you know, that we scientists had to be brilliant and correct. The first law of thermodynamics says that matter and energy cannot be created, that the sum total of all the matter and energy in the universe is a constant. It's a constant. That matter and energy cannot be created nor destroyed. You can transform one into the other. You can transform energy into matter or matter into energy, and that's the basic idea of the thermonuclear bomb. The second law of thermodynamics is the decay principle. The second law simply says you don't get something for nothing. The second law simply says that all systems left to themselves will always go downhill. There'll be less order, less information, more decay goes on. In other words, buildings collapse, trees age and die, people age and die, cars rust. Everything's going downhill. It's the principle that guards against perpetual motion machines. You don't get something for nothing. Now, our first chart, to try and explain this to you, is the evolution model at the top and the creation model at the bottom. In the horizontal direction, we have time on our first graph. In the vertical direction, starting at zero at the bottom, of course, we go from zero order, no order, or total disorder, upward. If we get to the top line, we would have 100% order, perfect order. So the degree of order can be measured. The evolution model, beginning at zero at the bottom left of our graph, teaches that a net increase of order is going on via continuing natural processes. Evolution is going on to higher and better things. So beginning down here at total disorder, first they say, for example, we'll generate particles and chemicals, still going upward and onward to organisms, then people, and of course people. We're not at the end of evolution. We don't know what is the end of it, so we have not yet reached perfect order, but we're working at it. The creation model is totally diametrically opposed. Again, with the horizontal scale going in time from zero and the vertical going toward 100% order, the creation model teaches from the Bible a net decrease of order following a completed perfect supernatural creation that 2 Peter chapter 3 also taught us about. In other words, a perfect creator created a perfect universe, not a chaotic universe. A perfect, all-knowing God creates perfection. Sin creates imperfection. So that we begin at the top of the chart at 100% perfect order, and ever since then, things have been going down. Now, you can see immediately that if you had perfect order, any change in perfection would at best be horizontally. That's the best you could do, is make a change that was horizontal, but keep it at the same level, because you cannot improve on perfection. And at worst, it would go downhill. Now, you can see here, as the two models are diametrically opposed, evidence against either one would constitute positive evidence for the other model. The problem is, either model can be modified by some kind of secondary assumption to accommodate any set of data. That's the problem. I don't care what you find in nature. Either one of the basic models can be accommodated to fit it. We'll think of something that will make it say, oh yes, that's, yes, but this happened, and so that still leaves us with our baby. So the point is that neither the creation model nor the evolution model can firmly be proved or falsified. What do you mean by falsified, Brother Floyd? The word falsified simply means this, that there's no experiment, the failure of which that experiment would destroy the teaching. You cannot come up with any kind of experiment that if the experiment failed, it would sink the teaching forever. Now, the second chart, I call the implications of the laws of thermodynamics. Beginning on the left side of the graph, time is on the horizontal, and the vertical, again beginning at zero, goes up to 100% energy. Energy on the left going vertically, time going horizontally to the right. Now, let the top line, therefore, represent the total energy in the known universe. It's a constant. That's the first law of thermodynamics. And we have three windows that we've drawn through our graph. The first window I want to call your attention to is the middle one, the historic window. Since people have been here writing and keeping historical records, the historical window, which I guess I could kind of liken to cosmos number two. the one that that is now that men have seen. Ever since men have seen, the first law would be a straight line across the top of the graph. The total amount of energy, 100% energy, is constant. So I've headed in that throughout the whole historic window. The first law. Ever since man has been observing, the second law has been moving, beginning at a higher point on the left side of that graph, going down gently toward the right. So the second law says all systems are going down. In other words, listen, even though the second law says this, that even though the total amount of energy in the universe is a constant, the problem is that even though the amount is there, the quality of that energy has been downgraded to the point you can no longer get it to do useful work. It's there, but we can't utilize it. The first window is the prehistoric time when nobody was there to tell us what happened. All right? The third window, which would, of course, the first window would be the same thing as Cosmos 1. And the third one, the future, it would say be Cosmos 3. Now, let's see what the implications of these two great laws of science are. All right? During the period of observation, the total energy has remained unchanged. Just like that. But the available energy for work continually decreases. That's our second law curve. Now, if we look into the prehistoric, the past, the first and second law curves will meet at time zero when total energy was totally available. That would be the moment of perfect order. In other words, if you just dash right across the top of your graph where you had 100% energy, keep your first law graph going to the left, and project backwards your second law graph, at some point the second law, which is going up in that direction, would intersect the top line of the graph. And that would be time zero. That would be the moment of creation. All right. So therefore, the second law teaches that if the present processes continue, if they continue, the universe will eventually die. In other words, let's project it to the right now into the future. The graph of the second law is going down toward the future. So if we project this down, eventually, the second law curve will hit the bottom of our graph. And what will happen is simply this. The universe will have died a heat death. Now, that's the heat death means that's when the whole universe reaches the same temperature, about 3 degrees Kelvin. Now, long before that, all life would cease to exist. 0 degrees Kelvin is supposedly that temperature, a minus 273 degrees centigrade, when all molecular motion stops. The second law, therefore, teaches, don't you understand, that if the universe were infinitely old, it would have already died a heat death. If it were infinitely old, this line would already have hit the bottom. Now, the fact that the universe has not died clearly teaches that the universe does not have infinite age. It has a finite age. The universe must have had a beginning, according to the second and first law. There is a place back there where they would intersect. So the universe had to have had a beginning. However, the first law says the universe can't create itself. Well, now we've got a problem. Don't we? We've got a problem. We're on the horns of a dilemma. The greatest two known laws of physical science are telling us something that doesn't add up. The second law says the universe had to have a finite beginning. The first law says, but I can't create myself. Therefore, the second law requires the universe to have had a beginning. The first law says it can't create itself. We've got a paradox. So the present laws had to have been superseded in the past by supernatural law. And as God is not creating anything today, and we read that in the scriptures before, Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 17 says creation is in the past. Revelations 4:11 says all things were created by Jesus. Were is past tense. Genesis chapter 1, verse 31 and Genesis chapter 2, verse 1 says that creation was finished. So the New Testament and the Old Testament teaches that creation is over. But evolution teaches and uniformitarian geology teaches, no it isn't, it's still continuing. New forms of life, totally different forms of life, are continuing to develop. Now, as God is not creating today, matter and energy appear to be a constant because there's no longer any creation but decay and conservation. Which brings us to our third chart. Beloved, science is what we see. Science is what you see, what you can observe. We see, when we go out into nature, universal disintegration. That's the second law of thermodynamics. Now, systems do not naturally go toward a higher order. The second law teaches all systems left to itself, random, and that's what evolution teaches, that it all happened randomly, that systems just don't naturally go toward higher order. Something's got to act on it from the outside. Now, evolution requires a universal principle of upward change. We're going from toward higher order, from simple to higher and more complex. Now, let's just examine this. Let's observe some criteria that would be necessary for increasing order in a system. For example, let's use a system of a growing plant. There are four basic principles that would have to be there for it to work. First of all, the first criteria is you'd have to have an open system. In other words, if the system was closed, you can't get any seeds in, you can't get any sunlight in, you can't get any water in, you can't get a lot, it won't work. You've got to have an open system. So we have an open system, and number one, a seed. Then you'd have to have some energy. If you're going to go against the second law of thermodynamics, if something's going to grow and increase in information and increase in order, you'd have to have some energy. Well, we do. We have the sun. Well, then you'd have to have a directing program, and you do. You have the genetic code, the DNA, in the plant. Well, now, it's wonderful to have the sun, but that's not enough. You've got to have something to convert the energy of the sun to do some useful work to make that thing grow. Well, the energy converter, of course, is what we call photosynthesis in the plant, and the plant grows. So someone can jump up and say, wait a minute, Brother Floyd, that goes against the second law of thermodynamics. Someone is defeating the second law. Trees grow. And there's nobody out there in nature, you know, quote, that you don't have to have a husbandman to tend the tree. It'll just grow. True, you can defeat the second law of thermodynamics temporarily if you have four things, as we've just learned. An open system, available energy, a directing program, and an energy converter. But the second law finally wins anyway. That tree finally gets old enough and it dies and rots. The second law always wins eventually. Praise God that Romans chapter 8 says Jesus is going to come and rescue all of nature from the curse and the result of the second law of thermodynamics. Now, let's consider building a building. You got to have an open system. In other words, you got to be able to get the materials in, materials out, and be able to work in that system. You'd have to have available energy. Well, we do. We have the sun. We have got tons of energy. There is no question that in nature we've got energy. The sun will give you enough energy to do almost anything. Most of us know that. We're beginning to work now on solar energy to heat our homes and to heat our water and things. Then we need a directing program. Well, we do. We'd have some architect or somebody to draw up some blueprints. But, beloved, you could take all the building materials you want, put the blueprint right on top of it, leave it out in nature, and let the sun bathe on it for 40 years, and you'll not see that building get built. In other words, beloved, it isn't the quantity of energy. It's got to have quality. There's got to be an energy converter. So, thanks to the sun growing the trees and the sun growing the plants and the horses and cows and things like that eating the plants, and I eat the plants and I eat the horses and cows, hopefully not too many horses, but these days in food you just don't know. My muscles get strong, and finally I come out there, and so I'm the energy converter, and if I'm not big enough to lift it, we get some electric motors and generators and things like that. We have energy converters. But you see, without an energy converter, nothing happens. In fact, what happens is the second law of thermodynamics just rots the blueprints, rots the building materials as it sits out there, doesn't it? Now, let's consider what we've learned against evolution's problem. For them to get increasing order, their system, let's consider the first living cell. Well, we'd have to have an open system, so that means we've got to get some complex non-living molecules in there, some chemicals. Is there available energy? Yes, they've got the sun. You know, the sun, well, we yes, tons of energy. But number two, three, we've got a problem. Evolution has no blueprint, no directing program. They say it happens randomly. Do they have an energy converter to get that non-living molecule alive? No, they've got the sun, but no converter. Let's look at the second problem, complex organisms. Open system, that means they'd have to have many simple organisms in it. Well, let's give them that. Available energy? Yes, they've got the sun. Do they have a directing program? Well, in the past, they appealed to natural selection, but you see, natural selection is not a directing program, and it's not an energy converter. It doesn't convert any energy. Natural selection is just a sieve, a screen that screens out any variant, any organism that's not fit for the environment. It kills it. It says, sorry, but you're not fit. You're going to die. So it's not, no. Natural selection is a wonderful screen, but it's not a directing program nor an energy converter. Well, do they have an energy converter? Well, they try to offer mutations, but you see, mutations are neither a directing program nor an energy converter. Mutations are purely random. So what I'm trying to get you to see is all real systems are open. The sun's energy to some point, some way, somehow, through some wave, somehow reaches all systems on the earth. So what I'm trying to get you to see is the hypothesis of evolution opposes the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, is evolution true? Well, I've tried to show you it definitely opposes what the Bible teaches, and it definitely opposes the best known law in physical science, to the fact that genes never mutate as to increase the order of the code, the genetic code. That leads us to our fourth chart. Time's arrows. I call this chart time's arrows. Evolution versus science. Observe, I did not say evolution versus the Bible. Evolution versus truth. Science is truth. I love good science. On our chart, again, on the left-hand side, going horizontally, we have time. And in the beginning here, going vertically, we go toward 100% order or 100% information. You see, for evolution to take place, you've got to increase the order. You've got to start with a simple cell. You've got to get simple chemicals, and you've got to increase information, increase order. Now, the second law of thermodynamics arrow starts at the top left at 100% order. And as time goes on, as time increases, it moves toward more disorder. In other words, entropy will increase. You say, well, Brother Floyd, what is entropy? Entropy, that's a highfalutin word that we use in thermodynamics to scare everybody. But it's simple. Entropy is a measure of the amount of energy that's not capable of conversion into work. See, a lot of times we've got a lot of energy available, but we can't get it to do work. And that's what the second law says. Oh, yes, the second law will admit that you've got tons of energy, but you've got to be able to do work with it. Now, let me just stop right there for a moment and help you to understand the second law just a little better, because it's so easy. Look, let this be a brick. Now, I place this on, a hot asphalt road.
Hot asphalt.
The molecules in this brick are moving randomly in all directions, according to the laws of physics. Boltzmann discovered this. And the molecules of that asphalt highway are randomly moving, randomly. And the more energy they get, the faster they move. If they could get enough energy, they might leap out of the brick or out of the road. That would take a tremendous amount of energy, because the cohesive force of each molecule is attracting each other and holding it into form as a brick. But if you could get enough, it would do like camphor. It would become volatile. It would volatilize. Just, you know, disappear, molecule after molecule. See, there's plenty of energy available in the road, getting all that heat. There's tons of energy. Now, if that brick just suddenly gathered up all that energy, heat energy from the asphalt road, and just suddenly took off down the road, see, it's got the energy. The energy is available for it to do it. Well, that would not violate the first law of thermodynamics. The first law says, fine, I don't mind that. That is consistent with conservation of energy. There's a lot of energy there, and you would be conserving energy if you did that. There's no problem. You wouldn't be creating or destroying energy by doing that. The energy is there. Now, as long as humans have observed, that has never happened. You can all kind of think about that. Have you ever seen a brick just sit on the road and suddenly take off? The first law of thermodynamics says, well, now, if it happened, it would be okay with me. That would not violate me. The second law jumps up and says, but baby, it would tear me up. Because the second law, let me write the second law for you in non-technical terms. The second law, which is a measure of the degree of disorder or the degree of molecular disorder, the second law says this, that in nature, order, and I'll draw an arrow, moves toward disorder. All systems left to themselves, unless something, someone comes and gets things going, will move toward disorder. Let's consider the opposite. Here's the brick on the asphalt road. I put my hand on it and give it a push. I gave it kinetic energy. I'm an energy converter. I've taken in food and now I'm converting it through my muscles, and I give it a kinetic push. As it goes down the road, the molecules in the book and the molecules in the road will begin to dissipate the kinetic energy into random heat energy. In other words, it will transform the kinetic energy of my push into what we call friction, random heat energy, the thermodynamic graveyard. And finally, those molecules, as they get more excited and they go faster and faster, and that makes friction, and finally the brick stops. That's what the second law of thermodynamics tells you is going to happen, and it does when you go out and look. It says, you gave it orderly motion, and what you ended up with was total random disorderly motion of the molecules of the brick and the road. In other words, I gave the brick as a whole an orderly motion. What I ended up with was disorderly random motion of the molecules of the brick and the road. I moved from order to disorder. That's the second law. It's wonderful. All right? And it's not so complex. For evolution to work, beginning at the bottom left, though, at time zero, with no order, no information, evolution's arrow of time has to go up so that information and order would be increasing, and that disorder or entropy would be decreasing. Now, here are the questions. Here are the important questions that we need to address ourselves to. Which one of those two, therefore, is really science? How is increasing information and order generated at the cost of entropy, at the cost of disorder? See, the evolutionist has got to answer that question. If we're going to intellectually, scientifically listen to him. As energy, this is the second law, as energy always flows in such a direction that disorder increases, or entropy increases, that's the second law, it's a measure of molecular disorder. In other words, again, in nature, order goes toward disorder, left to itself if it's random. And that's what evolution says, it's random. Question at Mr. Evolutionist. What is the code that directs evolution, that makes things more complex and higher in organization? Next question, what is the energy converter? What's the motor mechanism that drives it? Since everything in nature is going down, you can see that there must be, for evolution to be true, there's got to be some incredible universal principle of increasing order. We've never seen it. Name it. The creation model that we saw on the first drawing actually predicts the first and second natural universal laws. See, what I'm trying to get you to see is the evolutionist is embarrassed by the second law of thermodynamics. But not me. Not when you believe what God wrote. I'm not embarrassed by the two greatest laws of physical science. We predict it. We predict the law of conservation, that God would put conservation into effect to preserve the basic creations that they may accomplish their created purposes. And we predict decay. That is, as any change in a perfect creation by a perfect creator would be horizontal at best in order to preserve it, or it would be downward decay. In other words, toward mutations, toward extinctions, or toward atrophies. Fifth and last chart. Second law says all systems are decaying. In general, decay functions tend to plot on exponential curves. Someone says, oh, Floyd, I don't know what an exponential curve is. It's easy. An exponential curve, for example, would be like if you plotted 10 to the 0 power, 10 to the 1st power, 10 to the 2nd power, 10 to the 3rd power, 10 to the 4th power on a graph against a linear scale in the other direction. In other words, let's say, you know, what is 10 to the 0 power? What's any number to the 0 power?
1.
Correct. Good students out there. Yeah. If you plotted on one graph a 1, you know, go out 1, a linear expression 1, and plotted 10 to the 0 power against it, you'd go out 1 and up 1. Hallelujah, no problem. But look at the next one. Go out to number 2 on one of them, but go up 10 to the 1st power. See, those are exponents. 10 to the 1st, 10 to the 2nd, 10 to the 3rd, 10 to the 4th. Those are exponents. Now, when you go out 10 to the 1st, that's 10. So you'd go over 1 and up 10, or down 10, depending on which way you were plotting the graph. Woo, that's pretty quick drop-off, you know. 1 and then go up 10 the other. But look at the next one. You'd go over to your third position, your third equal linear position, and then you'd go to 10 cubed, 100, 10 squared, 100. Now, you got to have some pretty super graph paper to make this. You can see immediately. But look at the next one. When you go move over 4 and then go up or down, whichever way your graph is falling, to 10 to the 3rd power, that's 1,000 units. Well, you can, most of you that have ever done any graphing, you can see you're going to lose your graph paper pretty fast. Now, that's exponential. Now, again, in general, decay functions tend to plot on those kind of curves. So what an exponential curve looks like is, on our graph, beginning here at 0 time, going to the right horizontally, I drew this one the opposite direction. I put perfect order at the top because we're going to draw a decay function, and total decay or disorder at the bottom. 100% disorder would go to the bottom line of the graph. Now, therefore, here would be our normal decay function line, the top curve up here, an exponential decay. So observe that an exponential decay, that means they would fall off rapidly at first, then they would gradually attenuate and approach zero or 100% decay asymptotically. All right? Now, suppose we had an external catastrophe to the system. We've got something radioactively disintegrating, and we have some kind of external catastrophe, such as 2 Peter chapter 3 said, a special period of destruction, a flood. External catastrophes may speed up the decay rate for a period of time, then settle back to a normal decay rate. So the half-life that we observe in nature, decaying, may really be a constant, or at least appear to be constant for a short duration of observation. But you see, here we come out today at time T, and we observe this decay rate. Maybe we look at it over here and observe the decay rate back in here. But now nobody was around that's alive today and wrote down anything for us, you see, about what happened during that special period of destruction, the special period of catastrophe. Great error resulting in way too large an apparent age for a system would result if the accelerated decay rate is neglected and you made a calculation based on uniformity. Look, if you come to the period of the catastrophe with your projected decay rate and you don't take into consideration the catastrophe speeding up the decay rate, then you would uniformly project on back here so that finally that dashed line, the timeline reaching perfect order, the moment of creation, would be way, way, way back in the past. But what's really happened is it sped up very rapidly when it hit this and came up and hit this, the original theoretical curve line, and then moves on up very rapidly, so that what we're doing is getting very long periods of time because the people are not considering catastrophe. Now, someone ought to say this right about now. Well, Brother Floyd, I mean, these men are educated. What do they say when men like you confront them with the second law of thermodynamics and what you've presented to us today? What do they say? Make sure you understand that for evolution to work, to get a more advanced organism, somehow energy has got to be gained and information has got to be added to the system so that you can increase order. What do the evolutionists say? Well, not one geologist in a thousand took thermodynamics. They don't know anything about thermodynamics. They don't even realize they're violating law. They're philosophers. Most of them barely could handle basic mathematics. There was a course that we all had to take. Now, you think that's funny, but it didn't. There's a course you've got to take in order to graduate as a geologist. It's called structural geology. At best, structural geology is basic trig. Unfortunately, it's basic trig in three dimensions. That does build, that does make it a little tougher, doesn't it? But very few, listen, that's the course in geology that was weeded out those that were unfit for the environment. In the struggle for survival, natural selection screens out many would-be geologists in structural geology. They just can't do those three-point problems. And that's just basic trig. I mean, it's not really getting down to the good stuff like calculus and, you know, differential equations and theory of equations and wonderful stuff like that. And so this, now that's not bad-mouthing. That's just telling it like it is. Those guys, I went to five different universities, and I worked with over 200 geologists, and when it came to taking courses over in those departments, they ran from those courses like rabbits. In fact, I've never personally met a geologist that took thermodynamics. I'm not saying none ever did. I've just never met one. Moreover, very few geophysicists in the past. Now, the current generation is taking thermodynamics. But none of the older geophysicists hardly ever took thermodynamics. So what I'm saying is, we don't know that we're violating laws of science. Now, when you confront them that they are, what do they say to that? They usually have one of five positions to put forth. Number one, they say, well, the second law of thermodynamics does not apply to living systems. We're talking about living organisms, and it doesn't apply. Now, that sounds nice, and if they told you that, most of you don't have enough science to know any better, so you'd say, oh, and you'd go home saying, well, how about that? But I know better. You see, natural systems are kept and motivated and driven by complex chemical processes, and the laws of chemistry obey the second and first law of thermodynamics. So the first and second law do apply to chemistry and biochemical processes, all of them. Well, they say, well, maybe the second law is just a statistical statement. I mean, after all, maybe there's an exception somewhere in the universe. Well, that is possible. But let me just say this. If the second law has an exception, there are no known laws of physical science. This is the most tested one we know anything about. So, I mean, let's just give up on law. There are no laws if the first and second law aren't laws.